السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. This is Dr. Ali Zini from the Weekend Islamic School. And today the subject is that Islam is not an American religion and Muhammad is not an American name. Okay, that's we're replying to this. So, and let's see the introductory videos.
Tell me, what is the history of Muslims in America?
There were Muslims on Columbus's ship and traveling with explorers all around the New World. Up to a third of all enslaved peoples were Muslim, and the White House was built by enslaved peoples. So it's reasonable to expect Muslims helped build the White House.
Did we have any relations with Muslim countries in those early days?
Have you heard of the United States Marine Corps song from the halls of Montezuma?
To the shores of Tripoli,
that's
yes.
It. Well, Tripoli's in modern-day Libya, and the reason that's in the song is because we were allies with them. And as a thank you for helping them deal with piracy issues, the Marine Corps was gifted a sword, which has now become the saber of the Marine Corps dress uniform.
What? So many people don't know that.
And Thomas Jefferson was also hosting dinners at the end of Ramadan for Muslim diplomats in the White House.
Wow.
Jefferson once said that he knows the American experiment is a success when we can get a Muslim as a president.
I heard somewhere that the Statue of Liberty has some Muslim connection.
The designer based it on an Egyptian Muslim woman.
Oh my God, Lady Liberty totally has a Muslim face. And that kind of tracks because I feel like mine and her nose are very similar.
And we get town names like Ala, Arizona and Mahomet, Illinois, named after the Prophet Muhammad. These towns were not predominantly Muslim. They got these names as a sign of respect Americans had for Muslim cultures, Muslim civilization, Muslim people.
Do they build any mosques up in these towns?
Two of the oldest we have are in Ross, North Dakota and Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I would feel like that's the place you would say has the first Applebee's, not the first mosque.
We can look at the ways Muslims have inspired American architecture, but we can't forget the people like Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, who were turning to Islam to recover their heritage that had been taken away from them, and to say that you can't claim that there's only one way to be American.
And what about today's Muslim influencers, or as I like to call them, Muzfluencers?
I grew up in New York listening to Tribe Called Quest, and when they dropped their new album, I was really excited. And they performed with Dave Chappelle on Saturday Night Live, and I think it was the first time that both the host and the musical guests of Saturday Night Live were all Muslims.
Dave Chappelle is a Muz.
He is.
So is Ice Cube.
DJ Khaled, French Montana.
Shaquille O'Neal.
Shaquille O'Neal. In the Olympics, we had two American Muslim women, Ibtihaj Muhammad in fencing, and Delilah Muhammad, who won a gold in track and field.
The owner of Chobani is a Muz, and I eat one of those pumpkin Greek yogurts like every day.
And speaking of delicious food, the founder of Edible Arrangements is a Muslim as well.
Oh, hey, they look like flowers, but you eat them.
Muslims only represent about 1% of the American population.
How many of us are there?
About 3.5 million Muslims.
Here's a new stereotype about us. We are really bad at bowling, but really great at giving hugs.
You know the show The Simpsons?
Yeah.
Bart has a Muslim friend.
Yeah.
And if Bart can have a Muslim friend, I think we can all have Muslim friends.
Guys, go out there and get yourself a Muslim friend. We're pretty nice.
Learn from Bart Simpson. Cowabunga, dude.
Again, the subject is Islam is, reply to Islam is not an American religion. Muhammad is not an American name. You would be surprised.
A one-of-a-kind manuscript written by a slave has now been preserved in the Library of Congress. The Arabic language autobiography spent decades in private collections before the library acquired it in 2017. Now it has been digitized for the world to read. And Amna Nawaz reports on the manuscript's remarkable journey for our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
Born and raised in West Africa, Omar ibn Said was 37 years old when he was kidnapped and taken to America as a slave in the 1800s.
Before I came to the Christian country, my religion was the religion of Muhammad.
His autobiography, in his native language of Arabic, is believed to be the only one of its kind, the original words of a Muslim American slave.
Then there came to our place a large army who killed many men and took me and brought me to the Great Sea.
His literacy and culture completely goes against, abolishes, one might say annihilates the narrative that slaves were not capable of culture. In fact, they were persons with distinct histories, abilities, culture, and background.
Ala Al-Rayes has studied and translated the words of Omar ibn Said.
They sold me into the hands of the Christians, who bound me and sent me on board a great ship, and we sailed upon the great sea a month and a half, when we came to a place called Charleston.
He was wealthy, and he was highly educated, because in his autobiography he speaks about spending 25 years studying.
Mary Jane Deeb is the chief of the African and Middle East Division at the Library of Congress, where Ibn Said's manuscript now lives.
So there was a man who's caught at the age of 37, you know, and shipped off to South Carolina in a country he doesn't know, among people whose language he doesn't know.
Ibn Said wrote he was sold to a, quote, small, weak, and wicked man called Johnson. After years of abuse, he fled, but was caught in North Carolina.
He is then captured and brought to a jail cell, and he begins to write on the walls of his jail cell in Arabic. So that attracted attention of pretty important people, because the man who ends up buying him and releasing him from jail was the brother of the governor of North Carolina.
Over time, Ibn Said converted to Christianity. In his 60s, he wrote his own story, but only in Arabic.
It's written in Arabic, and so his masters could not really read it at all. They could not really influence its writing. And so it was really his exact words, unfiltered by the machinery of the editorship of masters and abolitionists, as other slave narratives were.
A machinery, Al-Rayes says, erased countless narratives, including the fact that up to 20% of Africans enslaved in America were Muslim. Ibn Said, in fact, chose to open his autobiography with a verse from the Quran.
The crux of this Quranic chapter is that it's only God who has the possession and the ownership, both of human beings and of things. And therefore, it seems to me a kind of a hidden text. What Omar is saying is that you guys have no right to own me here.
It's a narrative that challenges the original concept of who the slaves were when they came here. They didn't really have a system of belief. They were uncultured. They didn't have a written system. This is what he brings to the table and basically says that is who we really are.
But before those pages written by Omar ibn Said could be shared with the rest of the world, conservators here at the Library of Congress worked for months behind the scenes to bring those pages back to life.
We're trying to present the item as close to what it looked like at the time as possible.
Sylvia Albro led the effort to rescue the nearly 200-year-old manuscript. The materials themselves, she says, tell us even more about the life of Omar ibn Said.
It's actually surprising that the quality of paper for his manuscript is really pretty good. The fact that he had at his disposal good quality materials is an indication of the respect that he had as a figure, even as a slave.
That respect brought Ibn Said to the attention of prominent abolitionists, missionaries, and linguists at the time, who translated his story and used it in their fight against slavery. The entire manuscript is now available online for a new generation to read Ibn Said's words for themselves. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz in Washington, D.C.
And what a gift it is to all of us.
So Muslims lived in America and came to America long time ago. Okay, the areas of the three religions, all three religions came from the Middle East. So all three religions are imported from the Middle East. It's not that Moses was born in Chicago and Jesus was born in New York. They all came from the Middle East, from the same area. So you can say that they were all three religions imported from the Middle East. So it's not that Islam is the only one. It's all, they came imported from the Middle East. Muhammad is not an American, is not a Christian name, but Muhammad is an American name. And we have people with the name Muhammad who are prominent Americans, such as Muhammad Ali. there's something silly when there's a differences between Muslim Americans and racist non-Muslim Americans. The non-Muslims say, go back to your country. And how do you reply to that? By saying, I am in my country. I was born here and I don't know any other country. I am in my country right now. Now, immigrant Muslims accepted to be an American citizen when they were sworn to be a US citizen. They were adults. They made the decision while being aware of it. They were aware that they are being American. US-born citizens did not make that a choice. They became Americans by chance, means accidentally, without prior planning. Okay, so that's one thing in the favor of the immigrants. And the main difference between Americans, they don't say, go back to your country, because they respect each other's opinion and say, go, don't go back to your country. They don't say that because they all came from Europe, considered themselves natives. And in fact, the true Americans, if you want to talk about true Americans, are the Indians who were here first. If you disagree with them, they say love it or leave it. Love it or leave it is not an American culture, because the American culture is to love what is good and to hate what's bad. And hate is not so uncommon, because you might hate your neighbor, you might hate your teacher, but it's so don't think of the word hate as bad, as so bad. It just happens. It's a natural feeling. We had people who are saying that you are either with us or with the terrorist, which is George Bush after 9/11. And Bin Laden says that you are either with us or you're a hypocrite Muslim, okay? And we are against both of you. We reject both forms of extremism. And we were offended by George Bush's statement that if we disagree with him, then we are terrorists. And that's not right. We're against that statement. And we're against also the statement of Bin Laden, but both of them were extreme statements. What is the difference between propaganda and journalism? Propaganda is one-sided. It does not represent true journalism. You get both-sided, represented by equally talented people. Okay. And they both present both sides. Each side is presented by one party. And then you, the audience or the viewer, will make your mind, will make your selection. Well, I agree with this, I disagree with that. I agree with this and this and this and this, and I agree with there. And you are the audience, and select talented audience, you can pick and choose. But journalism is one-sided. And it hammers you with this side. It pushes that view into your throat. It selects for you. And this is the propaganda. And also, propaganda is when you bring an intellectual speaker with a layman who doesn't know how to speak. And they debate, and of course, the intellectual would win. But that's also another form of propaganda, which is one-sided. You emphasize one-sided, and then you marginalize the other side, okay? Intellectuals, many intellectuals are offended by the mainstream media because of the propaganda issue. They basically say, who are you to tell me what to select? You present them to me and my selection is my job. The differences between us, differences in language, differences in skin color, all these differences are natural differences intended by Allah. It's a sign of His greatness. We shouldn't punish each other for these natural and differences intended by our Creator. Punish each other for the color of skin, punish each other for the race. We shouldn't, because these are natural differences. It's a sign of Allah's greatness. Because if you think about it, if you buy Honda car, if you look at Honda car, same model, same year, same make, They're all the same, identical. Okay, but Allah is making each human unique and different. They are similar, but they are unique. They have unique different attributes. So that shows his greatness. The different languages, the different languages, the different colors, the different skin, the different cultures. This is a sign of his greatness. Okay. Allah doesn't judge us for that. Allah judges us for what we choose to be, not what he chose for us. He chose for us the race, the color, and the place of birth, and all of these things that he selected those for us. We are not judged by it. Okay. Allah will judge us by what we select, the choices that we make, whether they're good or bad. That's where we judge it by. Not because I'm black or because I'm white, because I'm handsome or not handsome. These are, we're not judged on those things because these are the choices of Allah. Okay, an issue comes about democracy. Are we democratic or constitutional republic? We are democratic. We are not democratic. We are constitutional republic. What's the difference? In democracy, majority vote wins. For example, if we say there is a vote, issue for vote, all Muslims should be killed. And let's say 70% said yes, 30% said no, then all Muslims will be killed. That's in democracy. In constitutional republic, that choice is not, it's against the constitution, so it's not available for voting. So you don't vote on things that are against the constitution. That's a constitutional republic, which is what we are here. This is important because the majority in a democratic society, the majority would take away the rights of the minorities. But in constitutional republic societies, the minority rights are preserved by the constitution, so they cannot be voted in. We Muslims as a minority here are protected by that we are constitutional republic state. However, recently it started to drift, the American culture started to drift away from being constitutional republic into democracy. And civil rights are being taken away because the majority think that they should be taken away. What is the American personality? American personality basically is something that changes with time. It initially started by your American because you own a land. Okay, you're a landlord. And with time, this view changed. Okay. But the Islamic personality is it's constant, pretty much is the same. It is a personality of a person who is inspired by the love of God, the desire to earn Jannah, and the fear of punishment. It is personality of a person who prays five times a day, and etc., etc., or a person who is inspired by the teachings of the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. This is the Islamic personality, and it doesn't change much because in the fixed, the moral values are the same, and they don't change with time and place. Pretty much, the variable part of the Sharia or the bar, this is the variable part of Sharia. This is changed with time and place, but the constant part which defines the Islamic identity is not, do not change with time and place. All over the history, Muslim Americans and Islamic personality and American personality can coexist. All over the history, Christians lived in a Muslim land, and the other way around. Muslim men can marry Jewish and Christian women. And this is in the Quran, Surah 5, verse 5. I remember it because it's 5:5 for the people who say Islam doesn't like non-Muslims. Muslims don't like non-Muslims and Islam discriminates. We say that Islam teaches Muslims to hate non-Muslims and kill them. We say, how could this be true if verse 5, give me 5:5. Verse 5, chapter 5 says that Muslim men can marry Christian and Jewish women. How can he marry this woman and at the same time hate his wife or kill his wife or disrespect his wife? The rights of a non-Muslim wife is preserved to the level that Muslim scholars were debating whether it is okay for a non-Muslim wife to drink alcohol, wine and things like that, because it's not against her religion. And she wants to drink at home, and even though it is forbidden by the husband, because the husband is a Muslim. And they were talking about the issue of using the husband's money to buy these ham, pork, or to buy alcohol. Okay, they were like questions and debates about that between Muslim scholars. But the Quran does preserve the rights of the non-Muslim woman, non-Muslim wife, who married a Muslim husband. Now, regarding the some people say why non-Muslim men cannot marry Muslim women. And the answer is that the husband, the man of the house, has an advantage, has a certain advantage, in, especially in the majority of cultures. The majority of cultures, the man of the house has an advantage. So and in Christianity, there is no verse 5, chapter 5, that would protect the right of Muslim woman who lives with a Christian husband or a Jewish husband. Actually, on the other hand, on the contrary, I remember a story of a Catholic wants to marry a Protestant, and they both went to the Catholic church, and they Catholic priest said, yeah, I'm happy for you, but I cannot get you married in the church. And the other way around, they went into the Protestant church and the priest say, happy for you, but I cannot marry you here. And they ended up just marrying by the judge, marrying them. But what I'm trying here to say is that there is intolerance in within Christianity itself, different sects of Christianity. It's not to mention between Christianity and Islam. So there is no protection to the wife of the Christian or a Jewish husband. There's no verse 5, chapter 5 that would protect the Muslim woman. So, and when people grow older, they become religious. And usually a Christian man will marry a Muslim woman when he's not taking Christianity seriously. And later they grow older, they become more religious, they start taking Christianity more seriously. And this is when the Muslim wife gets in trouble because there's no room for her in the Bible. So we can give you an example. We said that the American personality and the Muslim personality can coexist even in the same house. Even the most intimate relationship between husband and wife. So they can coexist together and they can cooperate together in certain areas. For example, I'm just picking up an example. The example of a noise pollution. In the past, noise pollution was not recognized until it was by the society. The society pressured until noise pollution was considered as a kind of pollution. Muslims and non-Muslims can also agree, can come to an understanding about the image pollution. So far, image pollution is not considered a kind of pollution, because it's not by the society. However, Muslims and non-Muslims, Muslims and Christians and Jews, can introduce that image pollution. I'm talking about image pollution, like bikinis on the beaches, one-piece bikini, a naked woman advertising some kind of a product. These are all image pollution. In the private space, people have the right to do whatever they want, but I'm talking about the public space here, the public space that needs to be protected because of the to preserve the values of the public and to make it suitable for the public. So both Christians, Jewish, and Muslim Americans can introduce this image pollution as a common kind of pollution to be considered and to be resisted, just like the noise pollution. Many people say that immigrants take advantage of things, like I heard a story of, like, it was a medical conference and there were immigrant physicians. The pharmaceutical companies were offering fancy pens as gifts for the doctors, and she said a few of the immigrant medical doctor means a very rich person, you know, like really rich. So she said that they come and they take more than one pen. They take advantage of this opportunity and take more than one pen. They go and they turn around and they take another pen. So she noticed that, and she was commenting on that. And then I mentioned that that immigrants grew up in cultures where there is not available, very little opportunities are available. And if you don't take advantage of an opportunity that's available for you, then you're really an idiot. So they are psychologically set to take advantage of opportunities whenever they are available. But the American-born usually grow up in an abundant environment, usually, and opportunities are usually available to select from, usually. I mean, it's not all the time. But there's no, the concept of taking advantage of something is not emphasized. So basically, we're saying that the immigrants are tested. The American-born citizens are taking credit in a test, or try to give themselves a credit in a test that they didn't take. They didn't take the test to start with, okay? But the immigrants, they are being tested. They are being tested. And if they pass the test, it means good. So if they get 70% is good, but for US born, they are at the level of 95%, because they were not tested to start with. They were not tested with this environment. The people who say, we don't want Sharia, we want to ban Sharia laws, the actual intent is that they want to say, we don't want Islam, but they are saying it in kind of implicit way, implied way. It's not so obvious. It's obvious, but it's not direct, okay, that we don't want Islam. But we explained that Sharia has two portions. The first portion is the portion that it's the responsibility of the individual. the individual is responsible for implementing and enforcing this part of Sharia. Okay. Such as praying five times a day, fasting Ramadan, it's harmless. It doesn't harm anybody. Paid charity, zakah, obligatory charity, going for Hajj. These are rituals that don't bother anybody and shouldn't be banned. We shouldn't prevent someone from practicing his or her religion. But the other parts of the Sharia, which is in responsibility of the state, which is an eye for an eye, a life for a life, an ear for an ear, a tooth for a tooth, you know, this part of like the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments also is part of the Sharia, Islamic Sharia, and there are more than Ten Commandments in Islam. And but the Ten Commandments in Christianity are part of the Ten Commandments in Islam, so that's part of the Sharia. Ten Commandments is part of the Sharia. And the eye for an eye and life for life and these kind of this kind of Sharia, part of the Sharia, is government, and it doesn't work. It's only for Muslim government to implement. And Islamic Sharia doesn't work, doesn't apply to non-Muslim states. It's only in a Muslim state that you can apply these things, and it doesn't make sense. So nobody wants to. So basically, most of the Sharia is already being applied today. The only part that's not applied is the part that's responsible. There is a question: if the law of the land prohibits Muslims from praying, fasting, pay zakah, or go to Hajj, what should we do? The answer is to leave the country to a land that does not stop Muslims from practicing the religion. It doesn't stop Muslims from practicing the religion. And there is another video here about
concern about a Muslim becoming president of the United States. Well, we decided in the wake of Dr. Benjamin Carson expressing concern about a Muslim becoming president of the United States. Well, we decided to launch a special Hannity investigation to find out if American Muslims think that Sharia law should supersede the U.S. Constitution. Earlier today, we sent out Fox News contributor David Webb to an Islamic cultural center in New York City. Now, watch this closely.
Your thoughts, should Sharia law supersede the U.S. Constitution?
No, but I think the Sharia law, it's made by God, by Allah, and the Constitution is made by people, so it's not the same.
Do you believe that Sharia law should be above the U.S. Constitution?
Yes.
Sharia law is completely different than the United States Constitution. As a Muslim, you practice my Islamic law. As a Muslim, but United States Constitution, as a citizen, I have to respect the Constitution. Nothing to do with Sharia law. It's a Muslim country, Sharia law is allowed. Other country, no. You have to have a right Constitution.
Should any religious law supersede the U.S. Constitution at any time? Any denomination?
Maybe in the future.
U.S. Constitution deserves all the people living in U.S. their rights, right? So Sharia law does not contradict with this. Sharia law just protects our dignified. We are like human being. Be respectful. To be respectful in the society.
So you think that the U.S. Constitution should be the law of the land in the U.S.?
Also helpful to protect our Sharia.
Should Sharia law be over the U.S. Constitution?
Yes, maybe.
Every country have a different policy and different law, but I respect the law in any country I go.
Do you believe that the tenets of Sharia law should be over the U.S. Constitution?
No.
That U.S. Constitution, which is made by people, and the Sharia law is made by Allah, so that is all the way above. That has to be definitely in the land, not for the America, for the whole world, would be above.
the Sharia law. So that should be above the U.S.
Definitely.
Constitution.
Yes.
Joining me now with Reaction, syndicated radio talk show host out of Boston, Howie Carr, the author of Demystifying Islam, Tackling the Tough Questions, the national spokesperson for the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, Harris Zafar, and Fox News contributor David Webb. You had a significant number, and by the way, this backs up a poll that came out last year that even a majority of Muslims in America think that Sharia should supersede the Constitution.
Yeah, and look, there was no problem getting these questions and answers from these folks. You saw a wide variety of them. We gave them a chance to answer. The problem, and I have this problem with anyone, anywhere who believes it, any religious belief supersedes the U.S. Constitution. We're a nation where the Constitution guarantees your religious freedom and where your religion does not trump it. Most people believe that in America, there are Muslims who want to live here and live under our Constitution, but too much we find a growing number of them that believe Sharia should supersede the U.S. Constitution. And one there admitted, look, in other countries, it's Sharia, but look at those countries where Sharia is the law.
Mr. Zafar, while you are a minority in the Muslim community in many ways, and more liberal-minded in your views, generally speaking, we know the application of Sharia renders or relegates women and minorities and other religious faiths to second-class citizens. So that's just a fact when you look at the application of Sharia in Muslim countries. So if you have more than half of Muslims in America that want Sharia, they are basically saying they don't support the U.S. Constitution, where you have freedom of religion and freedom of expression.
Yeah, it's what surprises me. The reason this surprised me, because the most fundamental principle in Islam on this subject is that the law of the land supersedes all other laws. So in the verses in the Quran that talk about government do not specify any religious involvement. They say put your trust in those that are in authority in your country, and it tells those people in authority to be just, not religious.
Okay, the application of Sharia in countries is women can't drive, women have to dress a certain way, they can't be seen in public with men that are not their relatives. In some cases, women need 4 male eyewitnesses for rape. Gays and lesbians are killed. Those that leave the faith are viewed as apostates. They are killed for such religious liberty. So the reality is, it is at odds with the U.S. Constitution, its practical application. Howie Carr.
Sean, obviously this is what Ben Carson was talking about when he said he couldn't advocate for electing a Muslim president. And this is just a very troubling fact.
So these are the stereotypes about the Sharia, and Muslims are like they say 1%, so they will never be more than 50%. And the American Constitution protects the Sharia. Okay, so the American Constitution guarantees freedom of religion, and freedom of religion means I can pray, I can fast, and these are all parts of the Sharia. So this one is intended to stereotype Islam, say why do we don't like Sharia. Another thing is that's also stereotypical is that Muslims, women cannot drive. This is only Saudi Arabia, was in Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia was like 30 million out of 1500 million Muslims. So when we judge, when we say Sharia says that women can't drive, we're talking about the opinion of 30 or like what's being practiced of 30 millions divided by 1500 millions. So we're talking about 0.02%, about 0.02 times 100, it's 2%. 2%. So to generalize this, 2% is not correct. And even today, the Saudi Arabia allowed women to drive. So there is 0% of Muslims who say that women can't drive. That's another stereotype that I have seen here.
So what should we make of all of this? I'd like to welcome Zainab Chaudhry. She's an outreach manager at the Council on
American Islamic Relations, or CARE. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
There are a lot of perceptions when it comes to Sharia law, and I want you to separate fact from fiction. Is there one basic set of laws under Sharia, or is it different in every place?
You know, Sharia is probably one of the most misunderstood aspects of the religion of Islam. Sharia itself means path to spring, or the path to a well of water. And really what it is it's guidelines, it's ethics and moral principles that people are supposed to apply in their daily lives to help connect them with God, to help them bring them more closer to God, and really attain like a higher level of spiritual connection with our Creator. And unfortunately, it's been so misinterpreted because of misreporting or what have you. Unfortunately, there's so many misconceptions about what the term itself actually means. What it really is that it's very essentially equivalent to, in the Judaic tradition, there's the halakha. It's similar to that in the sense that it's a way for people to attain a higher level of spirituality. And it's very different from fiqh, which is jurisprudence, or the actual application of those principles into the daily lives. There isn't any one interpretation. It can be interpreted very many different ways depending on the scholars and how they're viewing it.
So. And some people might think of some of the more extreme cases when they hear about it. You talk about misunderstanding. They may have heard or seen stories about stonings, rape, forced marriage. How real of a scenario is that under Sharia law? And where does this stuff happen?
So it's very important to differentiate between the principles of Sharia, the principles of fiqh, which is a jurisprudence or the application of Sharia, and culture and tradition. Stoning, there's different interpretations. It initially originates in the Bible, I believe, in Christianity. Even with forced marriage is absolutely not accepted in Islam. There cannot be compulsion in forcing any woman or any man to enter into a marriage against their will. Unfortunately, because of archaic traditions that have come down over the centuries, over the decades in different parts of the world, people use religion to justify these actions, but it's not Islamic.
You're an outreach manager at CARE. You've been active for a long time now. Do you feel like Islam is still misunderstood in many countries like the United States?
Absolutely. I think we're making progress in terms of helping to change a lot of the misconceptions that are out there. But unfortunately, because of global events that have captured headlines that have really helped to shape the perception of Islam and Muslims in the West, specifically in the United States or Canada or in Europe, it's really helped to create a climate of mistrust and fear towards Islam and Muslims, which really leaves the onus upon American Muslims, specifically in the United States, to help dispel the record or a lot of the stereotypes and set the record straight on what the religion actually is.
I want to ask you about something else that garnered a lot of attention. A few weeks ago, the Pew Research Center released a report saying that Islam will become the world's majority religion by 2070, surpassing Christianity. From your perspective, how will that impact the world? And what do you think of that?
I'm sure there were quite a few people who were very upset and horrified at that news. I think it indicates that there's a lot of interest in Islam. A lot of people are researching, especially because Islam has been in the headlines so much with the advent of horrific groups like ISIS and Boko Haram, who have been committing these atrocities, and has created a curiosity in some people to really understand like what kind of religion would condone these kind of actions. And they're realizing that these groups are not Islamic at all. And it's helping to encourage people to do their own research. And maybe I feel like maybe that's partly why there is more of a shift towards people who are embracing the religion. But I think that it's wonderful because it means that there's more diversity in the world. And anytime that there's more diversity, it enriches the global village. We really do live in a global village, especially with social media and the internet. We're all so connected in all parts of the world. And it's really something that we can leverage in a positive way to help spread understanding and tolerance and mutual respect of people of diverse faith traditions.
All right. We'll leave it there, Zainab Chaudhry. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right.